2 Samuel tonight. There was one sermon I read of Martin Luther's where he was preaching and then he said, "Enough of this gospel, now to the announcements." So, you know, we have done the announcements, now to the gospel. 2 Samuel chapter 15. This is the story of treachery in David's own house. This had been predicted by Nathan the prophet. "Behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house." That evil began back when Amnon assaulted his half-sister Tamar, and David heard of it but did nothing about it. Absalom took vengeance into his hands and arranged for his brother, the crown prince Amnon, to be killed in vengeance. David considered pursuing Absalom, but instead permitted him to be in exile for a couple of years. Then eventually Joab sent a woman to persuade David to let him come back. He has returned to the kingdom. And now we see what he is plotting to do. And these activities that we're going to read in verses 1 through 6 are really summarizing what the next 4 years was like after Absalom returned. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. What was the significance of that? That's right. The more people you have in front of you, the more important you are. With this great retinue of people, Absalom was sure to arrive any place he went in grandeur. But also, the chariots and horses were very much the prerogative of the king. And Absalom is showing that he is royalty by traveling in this way, in this chariot with the horses and the runners in front of him. So he is cutting an impressive figure in the kingdom, and everyone talks about his arrivals and departures. And then it says in verse 2 that Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. Now, what is significant here is that people are entering Jerusalem to come before King David for judgments, because the king now has taken over the role of the judge. And so it says, when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Now, let's talk about what he's doing. First of all, is there any significance to the time of day mentioned in this? Did you even notice the time of day? He gets up early in the morning. So what? He's there as soon as people start coming in to bring their suits and cases to the king. He's there when the earliest travelers arrive into Jerusalem. And he gets acquainted with them. He calls out to them. And he says, "Where are you from?" And then he finds out from what tribe they're from. And then what does he say to them? what he says to them is very much like what our friend the evangelist John Riesinger used to say when he was a pastor to couples that he was counseling in marriage counseling. He would hear the husband, he would say, "You're absolutely right, and I agree with you 100%. Then the wife would come in, tell him her side of the story, and he would say, "You know, you're absolutely right, and I agree with you 100%. You can't, of course, have it both ways. Absalom is telling everyone who comes, "You've got a good case. You're absolutely in the right." But he says there's just one problem. And what is that problem? Look at the text. There's just nobody around to hear your case. We're short-handed around here. You can't get through to the king. Is that true? How do we know that's not true? The woman Joab sent had gotten through to the king, presented her case. David was hearing cases. You see, you and I don't know what it was like to live before there was an internet. We can find out information like that. We know what's going on in the world, and if there's anybody sick in our church, or if a Wednesday night meeting is going to be canceled, well, we know within an hour or two. We are constantly on top of what's going on. We keep in constant communication with our cell phones and internet and so on. But back in those days, there was no way to get messages except by letters, which took a long time to deliver, or word of mouth. And so somebody could come to Jerusalem from one of these outlying areas and have a case to present before the king, and Absalom would greet them, and he would look every inch the king. He would be there in his royal robes, and he would say, "I know your case is right. I know you've got a good point there. I know you could probably convince the king, but we just don't have anybody who's a deputy from the king to bring you into his presence." And then they wouldn't check. They wouldn't say, "Well, you know, I looked it up on the website and the king does see people. Or there's telephone service and I found out that other people get to see the king." People didn't know any better. And they'd go home saying, "The king can't see me. And his organization is such and his administration is in such disarray that he doesn't even have anybody to hear cases." Now, what's that going to do back out in the hinterlands? It's going to foment discontent with David's dereliction of duty back in Jerusalem. The more people hear about this, the more upset with David they're going to be. But Absalom is saying, "I sure know that you could prevail, but there's no man designated by the king to hear you." And then he presses home his point that he wants to leave them with in verse 4, then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice. And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him." Thus Absalom did to all of Israel when he came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. There is something very famous about Texas's most famous politician, Lyndon Baines Johnson. And it's called the Johnson Treatment. How he would give other politicians, House members, senators, or lobbyists the Johnson Treatment. If you'd ever like to see a photograph of the Johnson Treatment, go eat a sandwich sometime at Katz's Deli, and there is a photograph of Lyndon Johnson giving the Johnson Treatment. What it was is that he would put his long arms around a man, and he was taller than most, so usually he was towering over the man. He'd put his arm around him, and he'd get him by the lapel, and he'd get right in his face. He'd get that nose and that chin right in his face, and he'd tell him what kind of a favor he needed. And that was the Johnson Treatment. And you saw him doing it every day, all day long, when he was the majority leader of the Senate. And he did it as president. And this is what Absalom was doing. He was giving people the Absalom treatment. He'd grab hold of them and kiss them. You got kissed by the Prince of Wales. You got kissed by the Crown Prince. You got kissed by the heir to the throne. What a story to take home. Well, I didn't get to see David, but boy, I saw his good-looking, long-haired son, and he was, you know, there with all of these runners, and he certainly treated me right and lamented the fact that he wished he could be the judge, and he said there wasn't anybody to hear my case. I'm a little disappointed in David, but boy, that Absalom, he's an up-and-comer. That was the idea. He was fomenting the rebellion for years, winning the hearts of people. And that's what verse 6 says. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Now this is not just affection. When someone steals your heart, they have your affection, your emotions. But the heart is more than that in the Bible, isn't it? The heart is not only the emotions, it's the intellect as well. It's the mind, will, and emotions. And so anybody would go back home and begin to spread the word that there was this impressive young prince who someday would do a whole lot better than his father, because he was there, Johnny on the spot, possibly before dawn, at the gate of Jerusalem, telling people, I'm sorry, you can't see the king, but you sure have a good case, and if I were here, I'd give you justice. Isn't obsequiousness nauseous? Obsequiousness and deference, and this is the way that Absalom deceived the men of Israel. He stole their hearts. Surely.
If David had treated Absalom a little bit more like a son than a criminal?
Yes, it may well have been. I think what we're finding out is that David was ineffective. He was neither punishing Absalom nor bringing him back into his good graces as a son. And this is what Absalom had asked for. He was saying, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now therefore let me go into the presence of the king, and if there's guilt in me, let him put me to death. So there was a 2-year time when Absalom returned that David wouldn't even see him. Then he kissed him, and there was a superficial reconciliation. But I think the problem started when David didn't deal with Amnon. That was the nail with the horseshoe that caused the horse to
swing. I remember when we went over that, and the thing that struck my mind, certainly it, about that whole story, was that, and I hated to say it then, and I hate to even think it now, nevertheless, Absalom did what David should have done. Mm-hmm. Absalom brought justice. He might have done it in vengeance, but he did do what should have been done with Amnon.
Yeah, or at least he arranged for the right result.
He arranged the right result. That's right.
Yeah, it was not done according to the Mosaic law, but it was done. That's right. And so.
And my point, the thing, and what I'm trying to straighten out, you're going to know in just the next chapter or two what deep affection David has for his son Absalom.
That's true.
And he had that kind of affection for the rest of his kids too, I'm sure.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that Absalom had the same affection for his father too. And Absalom did in the family what had to be done, and then got.
Well, you're basing Absalom's affection for David on what?
On just the fact that there was fathers and sons have a kind of a common affection. That's the only thing. Father's affections is hardly ever one-sided.
Yeah, I don't think the text much supports Absalom's affection.
Yeah, and that's the problem. The question that I'm sorting out is where did this start? Did it start? Was there affection? Was there real, true affection between Absalom and David up until the Amnon situation?
See, and
we don't know that.
We don't know. It could well be that Absalom was jealous of his older brother, even for having the right to the throne. Absalom is basing what he does on his own rationalization of what constitutes justice. And David, because of his love for all of his children, has basically violated Absalom's sense of justice. What we're going to find in this chapter is something that I think we find distressingly true of all of us, and that is that we don't do as well as we should in relationships and in decision making, but when persecution rises, when we're actually persecuted, that's when our thinking becomes a little clearer. And that's when we get back in our devotion to God. It's funny how persecution brings out the best in the church. It has historically. It brings a new devotion to the Lord. It brings a new love for His Word. It brings a new appreciation for the truth and a cherishing of all that is good. And that's what it's actually going to do in David. David really bounces back in this chapter. He becomes active again and thinking the Lord's thoughts again and seeking the Lord again. But it's almost like David is immobilized concerning his family. He doesn't know what to do. And what we can guess here is that he doesn't suspect what Absalom is doing. I think we're going to see in just a moment that he very much trusts Absalom now and has no idea that he is stealing away the hearts of the men of Israel. To pick up in verse 7, at the end of 4 years, and see, that's what our writer is saying, this goes on. For 4 years, as Absalom builds up his constituency. And so at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I lived at Geshur in Aram, saying, 'If the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord.'" Now, the interesting thing is, Absalom made a vow at Geshur, way up to the north east. But now he wants to go down to the southwest to Hebron. What was the significance of Hebron? That's where David first became king. That was where David began his kingship. It's also where Absalom was born. And this may have been one of the reasons that David didn't suspect anything. Oh, he wants to go back to his hometown, his birthplace. But he says, if the Lord, I want to go to Hebron to pay this vow to the Lord that I vowed while I was up in exile, up in Geshur. Verse 9, the king said to him, go in peace. And of course, this is an extremely ironic statement. David trusts Absalom. He does not understand that more should have been done to have the relationship with him or bring him back into his affections. He simply, grudgingly brought him back after 2 years and he kissed him, but obviously he thinks that's enough and he has no thought that Absalom is planning any treachery. The king said to him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king at Hebron. Now, isn't this interesting? Again, this is before the internet, and therefore this was an extremely complex and elaborate plan to plant people so that perhaps within the space of a day that a message could be sent throughout the land. There were people placed at strategic places with the shofar ram's horns, and they were going to sound the trumpet. We can't assume that it would happen at a given hour or even at a given time of day, but perhaps it could have actually been accomplished during the same day. And it was a carefully coordinated plan. As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king at Hebron. And with Absalom went, and this is interesting, 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. What's the significance of that? Here are 200 men from Jerusalem. The fact that they were invited guests should tell you something about them. They would be high ups. They would be what Mark Twain used to call the quality. In other words, they're aristocrats. Sorry, say aristocrats. They're aristocrats. That's right. They are chief men. They are men of prestige. But they're innocent of what is going on. If they're not co-conspirators of Absalom, why would he want them with him?
It looks like they're with him.
It looks like they're with him.
Make it easier to get their support.
Make it easier to get their support because once, you know, people start proclaiming Absalom as king, then, you know, these guys who have essentially been kidnapped and lured away from Jerusalem are going to go with the flow. They're going to go with whoever is encouraging them to proclaim Absalom king. And then the third thing is, because they're with Absalom, they are
not with David.
That's absolutely right. He has gotten them away from David. They would have been David's supporters, and they're going to wind up, at first perhaps reluctantly, but then pragmatically, throwing in their lot with Absalom. Very clever maneuvering. And while Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city Gilo. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. Now, Ahithophel was David's Karl Rove. Ahithophel was the architect. And this was Absalom's coup d'etat. He was going to get Ahithophel and Bob. Do you remember who Ahithophel was? Somebody who would readily turn against David. Why? Wasn't Tamar's grandfather, but he was somebody's grandfather. It was Bathsheba's grandfather. She was the daughter of Eliam. Eliam was Ahithophel's son. And so Ahithophel has reason to betray David. He is David's most trusted counselor, and Absalom gets him on his side. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. In Shakespeare's play, King Lear, he has a line that has become very much quoted outside that play. How sharper than a serpent's tooth is a thankless child. And one of the greatest of all betrayals is when your son or your daughter turns against you. And this is what has happened to David. Absalom has now very cunningly and cleverly over a long period of time gathered support, and now he is ready to strike. Verse 13, and a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. Let's look at David's reaction and see if we're surprised at it. Verse 14, then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Does that surprise you? That he says, well, then we've got to get out of here. Why does he say that? David's a military man. And he has determined it is time to retreat. And he said, and he determines it immediately. Why? He's what?
He doesn't know who the army is.
Yeah, he doesn't know all the details about the army, but he knows that this is the culmination of a long and sinister plot. Absalom supposedly has turned the hearts of men of Israel, and so they are no match for him in a siege. They're not going to stay in Jerusalem and try to defend it against a siege from who knows how many soldiers. So David knows.
He was trying to protect Jerusalem.
Yes, that's true. He says, lest they bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. That is an extremely important point. I think that there's also another factor here, and it'll be clearer as we go on with the story. But I think there's something else. David does not want to fight his son, if at all possible. And so he knows that his son is probably ready to kill him. There will be no escape for us from Absalom. But he is not ready to, of course, see Absalom die. So he says, let's get out of here, protect Jerusalem, protect ourselves. Verse 15, and the king's servants said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides. So the king went out and all his household after him. And remember, he had numerous wives and concubines. He left 10 of them, it says. The king left 10 concubines to keep the house. That will become very significant. And the king went out and all the people after him. And they halted at the last house. Here they are at the city limits of Jerusalem. And there they stop. And there's kind of a passing review. It says in verse 18, and all his servants passed by him, and all the Kerethites, and all the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. This is an extremely ironic verse. This verse 18. Who were these people? Kerethites, Pelethites, and Gittites. You don't need to tell me about their geography or place of origin, but what were they doing? Why were they there?
They were
mercenary soldiers. They were mercenary soldiers from other countries. Kerethites were from Crete. The Gittites were from the Philistines. The Gittites were from Gath, home of Goliath. And one of the things that you have to look at as tremendously ironic is that David has lost the affection of his son. He is fighting against his own son, and yet he has won over the loyalty of these non-Israelites who have come and are willing to defend him. And the irony gets even more intense now. It says to verse 19, "Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, 'Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home.'" What David is saying to this man is, you shouldn't be involved in my personal problems. You're a foreigner. You're not even an Israelite. And you should go stay with who? The king. He is acknowledging that Absalom is probably going to be the king. And so you need to go serve the king. You're a foreigner. You're an exile from your home. Do what's best in your own interest. I think I first became aware of this character he's talking to one time when I was attending a theological conference. And R.C. Sproul was telling about how the pastor of the church in which we were meeting had talked to him before he preached, and he said, "I want to try to be as loyal as Ittai the Gittite." And R.C. Sproul went over to Dr. John Richard DeWitt, professor of theology at Reformed Theological Seminary, and he said, "Dick, who is Ittai the Gittite?" And Dr. DeWitt said to him, "You mean Ittai the Gittite?" And Sproul felt even more idiotic. "This is Ittai the Gittite. And you should mark Ittai the Gittite if you've never heard of him before tonight, or if you haven't thought about him in years. This is a little Bible cameo of true loyalty." David says to him in verse 20, "You came only yesterday," that's a figure of speech, recently, "you came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us, since I go, I know not where? Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you." And this is David at his best, saying, "You just don't have any dog in this fight," to put it in West Texas terms. "You do not have any stake in this. So take your Gittite army and go on home. And may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you." And here's the great verse in verse 21. "But Ittai answered the king, 'As the Lord lives and as my Lord the king lives, wherever my Lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be.'" Who does that sound like? Ruth. Sounds like Ruth, doesn't it? And her loyalty to her mother-in-law from another country and another culture. And Ittai the Gittite felt that loyalty toward David. And you can't help but think of this pang of irony that here is Ittai the Gittite acting more like a loyal son than Absalom. And we do so find that, don't we, especially as Christians, that our spiritual brothers, even our spiritual children and spiritual parents, fulfill their roles to us so often more than our natural family does. Ittai is speaking to David as Absalom should. Verse 22, "And David said to Ittai, Go then, pass on. So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him." And what that's telling you is that these families were leaving. These were evacuees from Jerusalem. These were people leaving Jerusalem just like people have left these cities where the hurricanes have hit. They were going out with their beloved King David in groups of families to the extent that their children were with them. "And all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by. And the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness." The brook Kidron runs on the east side of Jerusalem, and it runs north and south. Do you remember someone else who crossed over the brook Kidron in great sorrow? Our Lord Jesus Christ. After the Last Supper, he crossed over the brook Kidron, and he took this very route that David is taking. Up the Mount of Olives, Jesus went to the Garden of Gethsemane. So here is David taking the route that David's greater son will one day take when he is also betrayed and about to be delivered into the hands of men. Verse 24, "And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok came up also with all the Levites, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God." Here are two priests. First, there's Abiathar. He's now much older than when he started out with David. David had basically orphaned Abiathar because his father, Abimelech, was the one who protected David at Nob and was killed for his trouble by Saul. And David took his son in, Abiathar, and he became David's priest. Now Zadok has come on the scene, and he is co-priest with Abiathar in Jerusalem. And Zadok is very significant because he is the fulfillment of that prophecy that we read so many months ago when we started 1 Samuel, that Eli's house would no longer serve the Lord and would no longer preside in the temple of the Lord. Way, way back at the beginning, it was prophesied that Eli would no longer serve, and God said in 1 Samuel 1:35, "I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever." So here is someone, also a Levite, but from another branch of the family, Zadok, who then becomes the major priest over time and is the priest who anoints Solomon king. Zadok and Abiathar come up with all the Levites, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God, and they set down the Ark until the people had all passed out of the city. What are they doing with the Ark? Why are they bringing the Ark? Anybody have any idea? It could be to protect it, but I think it's more to protect David. What did they think the ark would do?
Bring a victory,
protect them in battle. Of course, God had shown long ago that that was not going to happen, and he let the Philistines capture the ark. And David knows that it doesn't matter if they've got the Ark of God. What he wants is God's presence. He wants God's approval. And so in verse 25, "Then the king said to Zadok, carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him." This sounds like our old David, doesn't it? Persecution has come, trouble has come, and he is now making decisions that are wise, showing compassion, and absolutely putting himself in the hands of the Lord. Verse 26 is an amazing verse, and it's an attitude that we all ought to have. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him. So you see how hundreds of years before Jesus took this same route, David is essentially taking the same position that Jesus came to about our salvation. Not my will, but thine be done. Whatever he wants to do to me, let him do to me. And he'll do it whether we take that ark with us or not. Verse 27. The king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? In other words, aren't you a person of divine insight? Can't you see situations? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. So what's David doing here? He has spies in place. The two priests will be his spies. And they will be finding out very quickly what's going on. What David is doing here is a model for us in this last part of the chapter. And the model is this. And you can put it in the form of an old military slogan. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. What does that mean? You've heard it. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
It means you're praying for God to take care of them, but also we're going to take care of ourselves.
That's right. You are praying for the Lord's will to be done. You're trusting absolutely in the Lord, but that does not mean you're passive. It does not mean that you're simply lying down. You are making pragmatic plans and putting things into place. You are doing what you can. You have here the great secret of Calvinists, belief in divine sovereignty and human responsibility. You are trusting in the Lord completely, but you're doing all you can naturally. And that's what David's doing here. He has gotten back to his old self in this affliction and pressure. He's trusting the Lord, but making good plans. And we'll see some more here. He knows his situation is very desperate. And verse 30 is an extremely poignant verse. But David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot. Barefoot was a sign of mourning. He's mourning about what's happened in his own family. There cannot be a minute that goes by that he does not see the face of Absalom and can hardly believe what's going on. He went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads. And they went up, weeping as they went. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Now this is, again to quote from Shakespeare, the unkindest cut of all. Not only has his son turned against him, but his most reliable and trusted counselor has turned against him. It would be like Karl Rove went over to Hillary's side. Something like that. Someone goes over to the other side completely. And David says, oh no. But look at what he does. David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Now that too is a very pragmatic approach. There's no other way that David can influence Ahithophel. But he has a God who can influence Ahithophel. And furthermore, he has a God who can do it either one of two ways. He can either make Ahithophel say foolish things that are against Ahithophel's better judgment, or he can make Ahithophel say wise things and make the hearers of Ahithophel say, that's foolishness. But David puts Ahithophel into the hands of God. And I think that this is a tremendous lesson for us too. When there are people who are against us and we have absolutely no control over what they think or what they do, we can call upon God to influence them and change their hearts and just simply pray for them. I never will forget one time when I was counseling someone and I said, you know, the Lord's been dealing with me about this and this lately in my life. And the person I was counseling said, good, I was praying that he would. I thought, thanks a lot, you know. I'm supposed to be doing the counseling here. But the counselee was praying for me that I would change one of my attitudes. And it worked. We can pray for others. David has no way of dealing with the threat of what Ahithophel will advise Absalom, because it's going to be good advice, except to say, oh Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Now, sometimes we have to really pay close attention to the context of Scripture. You remember when Ruth went back to Israel with Naomi? And you remember that everybody greeted Naomi? And Naomi said, the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. I am bitter. I went away full. I have returned empty. I don't have anything. And there standing right beside her was Ruth, what God had given her. So David prays this prayer, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Let's go as fast as we can. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. David prays this prayer, and all of a sudden another counselor comes down the hill. And he is there with his coat torn and dirt on his head. What does that mean? He's mourning. He's upset because of this crisis. And David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. Nobody knows exactly what that means. Maybe Hushai was so old, so elderly, that David said, you'll be a burden to me. But he said, but if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant, then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Isn't that great? He prays and God provides immediately. He prays about frustrating the counsel of Ahithophel, and lo and behold, Hushai the Archite, who he can send back to be in Absalom's camp, will defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. The Lord has provided. He tells Hushai the plan. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. And behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send to me everything you hear. Before we read the last verse, do you see how David is relying on the Lord, and yet he is still using strategy? He is still taking the initiative. He is practicing what we might call both piety and pragmatism at the same time. But he is, on the one hand, absolutely trusting the Lord, but not being passive. He's doing what needs to be done. Any other comments on this situation? Have any of you ever experienced the kind, just not necessarily in your own life, but in people you have known, this kind of enmity between a child and a father or mother. It is, I suppose, one of the worst possible conflicts in all of human relationships. This is, you know, a father who has known Absalom from a baby and has been a father to him, and now Absalom has turned in betrayal on him. And so it is an extremely sorrowful situation. And we're going to look at the last verse. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. What does that sentence say to you? We certainly believe in coincidences. But what do we believe about most coincidences?
That they're not
just coincidences. That they have been ordained of God. And so, just as Absalom gets to Jerusalem, there's Hushai, David's friend, ready to volunteer and sign up with the revolutionaries. And God has ordained it. And the interesting thing is that David knew at this time that God would save him, that salvation and deliverance belonged completely to the Lord. And he wrote a psalm about this whole event, possibly while he was fleeing, because it says, as I turn it up here in the title to the psalm, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. And the psalm is Psalm 3. And I'd like for us to sing it together tonight. Here. Eddie, would you take these and begin to pass them back? I'll take them.